对，we're starting here on the top of Tzadik Chet Amud Aleph, two lines down. Hai itito, the tafsa kasa de kaspa b'ktubata. She grabbed a silver goblet for payment of her ktubah, the assumption being that the ktubah was larger than the silver goblet that she grabbed, so there's still an amount that she needs to be paid after this. Katava mizone. And now she's asking for mizonot, based on what we saw yesterday, whether you have been pogem in the ktubah, meaning that you've already collected a portion of the ktubah, do you still have rights to mizonot? That we saw was a machloket between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Shimon says, as soon as you've taken a portion of the ktubah, you're deemed as if you've collected the whole ktubah, you're no longer entitled to mizonot. Whereas Rabbi Meir believed that until the entire ktubah is collected, then you have rights to collect mizonot, and the woman has rights to sell the estate in piecemeal to get her ktubah. So in this instance, this would be subject to the machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon. So atay lekamei derova. So she came before Rova to get her mizonot, or at least be allowed to take mizonot from the estate. Amar lehu liatme, Rova turns to the tomim and says to them, zilu havula, mizonot. Go ahead and give her mizonot. Leit techash leha de Rabbi Shimon. Nobody holds like this sheet of Rabbi Shimon. Damar lo amrinan miktzat kesef kechol kesef. As we saw yesterday, Rabbi Shimon's opinion that a portion of the ktubah is not deemed to be as if you have the whole ktubah still. He says that that's as if you don't have a ktubah anymore. You've collected your ktubah, and therefore you would not be entitled to mizonot. Here, Rava makes the statement clearly that the halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon. Likely because our Mishnah, Rabbi brought the Mishnah, Stam Mishnah, like Rabbi Shimon. We said, who was the author of our Mishnah yesterday? We said it was Rabbi Shimon. So here, Rova says, despite the fact that the Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Shimon, nevertheless, no one is choshesh for the Shita of Rabbi Shimon, and the Locha is not like Rabbi Shimon. Shalach lei Rabbo b'rei Rova, the Rav Yosef. So Rabbo, the son of Rova, sends a Shaila to Rav Yosef. Mocheret shelo b'beitin, Tzricha Shvua, or ain't Tzricha Shvua. A woman who is selling not under the auspices of Beit Din, on her own, is she required to take a Shvua, or is she not required to take a Shvua? Rashi says, what is this Shvua for? Shelo gavta yoter. That she didn't take more than she deserved. Here she is active in selling the property of the Yitomim. So we worry about the fact that she might have taken more than she deserved. So therefore, the nature of this Shvua is not the typical Shvua that an almanah would take is lotifra mina yitomim ela im shvua, that you're not allowed to collect from yitomim except through a shvua. Over there, the shvua is that you did not withhold additional monies. Sarare, that the husband didn't already give her your money, and now you're trying to collect again. So that's a separate shvua. This shvua is because of her activities with regards to the estate itself, that she didn't take more than she deserved. Tosafot, along those lines, starts out with Rashi's pshat and then rejects it and says that he thinks that the nature of the shvua here is shelo zilzala, that she did not sell them below their value. She did not cause losses to the estate in her activities acting on behalf of the estate. So therefore, she takes a shvua, shelo zilzala, that she did not depreciate the assets. She did not cause losses to the estate. On the other hand, there are a slew of Rishonim. You can know that that is the case because Tosafot himself quotes it originally and then rejects it. But the Tosafot read, you can see over here, another Rishonim suggests that this is the typical Shvua of an Almanah. Typical Shvua of an Almanah is Lotifra, Ela, Mina Shvua. She can only take from the estate with a Shvua. And the question is, when does she take this Shvua? Does she take this Shvua before she acts as an agent to sell the assets of the estate, or does she take this shvua after she has acted as the agent of the estate? So the question of when she's collecting her ktubah, when does she take this shvua? So they say this is no different than the shvua that an almanah would normally take, just a question of placement. When would you take this shvua? So you have three different opinions as to what this shvua is, that Rabbo Brei Rova is querying Rav Yosef as to whether an almanah takes such a shvua. Now, it's true that, and we're going to see this already, that it's true that she may not sell it without some sort of formalized assessment of the property price. Now, she may not have to go through, and we're going to see this in a second, she may not have to go through the formal channels of Beit Din, but she still needs at least three hejotot that give an assessment of the property. So that's what Rav Yosef responds, "V'dibay locha hachraza. Why don't you ask me whether it needs hachraza?" Amalei hachraza lo kimivayile. So Rabbi Breda Rova responds and says, "Hachraza, I don't have any questions about." Now, why Rav Yosef raised hachraza? The two views of why he raised the hachraza here: either it's because, in terms of order, that if before you would sell the property, you would do hachraza; after you've sold the property, you would take a shvua. So, if you're asking about a shvua, why don't you ask me about the issue of hachraza? Hachraza is the public auction of the property, and generally, when we're selling assets, either against the will of the individual or without the knowledge of the individuals, we require them to do it through baking with achraza, through a public auction, thereby assuring us that you're getting the full price or the highest price for the property. So over here he's saying, why don't you ask me whether this woman has to actually go through a process of achraza here, rather than the fact that she could just sell the property without going through this huge public auction. According to many of the Rishonim, not that it's a question of order, that achraza comes with Rishua, but one is taloi in the other. Like, for instance, Tosafot, who thinks that the problem here, why she's taking a shvua, is that she didn't appreciate or mezalzel the property. So then, if she does achraza, then there's no longer a worry that she needs a shvua. So therefore, the questions are connected. If she does achraza, she won't need a shvua. If she doesn't do achraza, then she will need a shvua. And that's why Rav Yosef pushed back on Rabbi Reid Rova and says, why don't you ask me about achraza? So then, Rabbi Reid Rova says, that's not a question to me. Why? Damar Rabbi Zeir, Amar Rav Nachman. Almana sheshama la'atzma lo asta v'lo klum. An almana who assesses the value for herself, she did nothing. Meaning that if she purchases the Yitomim's property, then we deem that as to be a no sale. Heichidami. What's the case there? Idachruz amay lo asta v'lo klum. If it went to public auction and she bought it at public auction, why are we worried about her self-dealing over here? Because it went out to the public auction. She was the highest bidder on the property. Then it seemingly should be a full value, and why shouldn't she be able to buy it? So, and therefore, it makes sense that elalav d'lo achruz. It must be a case where she did not do a public auction. Ulatzmahu d'lasta v'lo klum. And now we're medayik, and what Rav Nachman says is that only when she's self-dealing is it a problem. If she sells it to herself, it's an issue. Ha l'acher, masha asta asta. But if she sells it to a third party, what she did is done. So from this, Rabbi Breda Rava concludes that from Rav Nachman it's clear that she has the ability to transact in the properties. As long as she's not selling them to herself, she can sell them to a third party, even without achraza. So that's why he concluded, Rabbi Breda Rava, is that there's no need for achraza over here. The only question is there a need for a shavua? The Gemara seemingly answers, whether it's Rav Yosef himself answering back, or the Gemara interjecting this, and saying that they don't think the diuk is correct. The olam d'achruz. Now the case is here where there was a achraza. But the amila man shamlich. And the question is, who assessed this for you? So now Rashi and Tosafot take a very similar approach as the man shamlich, which is, who granted you the rights to buy it? Because neither Beit Din nor the Yitomim granted her the right to sell it to herself. And they didn't, you have to have a selling party for the buying party. So over here, what they say to her is, listen, you bought it for yourself, but nobody sold it to you. The Yitomim didn't sell it to you, and neither did Beit Din sell it. Right. Well, so what type of transaction have you created over here? The Gonim, on the other hand, say, Mam Shamlech, who assessed the value for you? Who went ahead and made sure that this is the proper value of the property? Now that is somewhat difficult because she has to do it in front of Shlosha Hedyotot. When we say here there's no achraza and there's no Beit Din involved in the sale, that doesn't mean that she just sells it in a private transaction. It still means that she has to utilize a Beit Din shel Shlosha Hedyotot and get some sort of assessment of the property. Now the Gonim's claim is that when you have Shlosha Hedyotot assessing the level of the property, then when we say Man Shaimlach is, when they did it, they knew you were selling it to yourself. So they didn't bother to assess it fully or properly because they thought it was all for show that she was doing this in order to buy it for herself. So the claim is, did you get a proper assessment of the property because they knew you were self-dealing? And so they thought, what's the big deal about assessing the real value of the property? She's going to buy it herself anyway. So based on those claims, which is either the problem is that who assessed the property for you, meaning who assessed this value for you that you're allowed to now buy it because the auction wasn't either done properly or the assessment wasn't done properly because they knew you were going to buy it anyway. So nobody else bid because they figured it's going to her anyway. Or they didn't assess it properly because they knew it was going to her. Or from the perspective of Rashi and Tosafot, nobody gave her permission to buy it because there was no seller to her. She might have been empowered to be an agent of sale, but she wasn't empowered to be the buyer from the Beit Din or from the Yitomim. So those are the two ways to view the claim against her in this case, which is interesting because the Ritva claims that there's actually a nafka mina between those two, is when she was made a shliach to sell the property. When she was actually made an agent to sell the property. Even in that instance where she's made a shliach to sell it, then she has the selling rights. The selling rights were granted to her because she was empowered either by Beit Din or Yitomim to sell. She's made the shliach to sell it to a third party, not to sell it to herself. Self-dealing will still be a problem in the case where she's made into a shliach to sell the property. On the other hand, if the problem here is assessed value, so in that case, you could argue that if she was made an agent to sell the property at a given price or a fixed value, and therefore maybe she could buy it because she was empowered to sell it at a given price, ki hai dau gabro. So now the Gemara brings an example of such an instance, dafkidu gabei kista diatme. So there was deposited with him something of the Yitomim. Rashi says the kista brings two different interpretations. One is mispo, that it was some sort of feed for the animals, or the more likely scenario is that it was amog, which is coral wood that was deposited with him, which seemed much more expensive, valuable wood. Azal shama lenafshe ba'arba me'azuze. He went ahead and assessed it at 400 zuz for himself, and he purchased it off the Yitomim. Iyaker, and then it went up in value, kam b'shitmea, and now it was worth 600 zuz. Ata the kamei d'Rabbi Ami. So he comes to Rabbi Ami, amar lei man shamlach, and he says to him, who assessed the value for you originally? Meaning that the asset had appreciated. So then the question is, who granted you the right to buy it? According to Rashi and Tosafot, you were never empowered to buy it because there was no seller to you. Or according to the Gonim, you never got a proper assessment of the item, and therefore, how could you buy it? And therefore, the appreciation belongs to the Yitomim. Now, there is a problem here for sure, which is, why did you have a right to sell it at all? Even in the cases, we know in the Gemara and Bava Metzia, even in cases of losses, when you have a pikadon etzlu, but with you, we wait until we're absolutely necessary to sell an object before we sell it. The losses have to be substantial, or that they will be an impediment to the maintenance of the object before we will let you sell the object. What right did he have to sell the object over here? Some of the Rishonim suggest that that's what he was empowered to do. He was actually, the pikadon was placed with him to watch it and to monetize it, to sell it. Despite that fact, he's still not allowed to buy it himself. He's not allowed to self-deal because of the problem of Mam Shamlach, who granted, who either was the seller to you, or the more importantly, who was the one who assessed the value for you in this case that gives you permission to buy it.
It's like a conflict.
Right. In any sense, we don't want you dealing with it because there's always suspicions. Now, there could be, here, the Gemara is raising real suspicions with him that there might be a misvaluation of the property or there were no rights granted to you to buy it yourself. But even without that, there's just a maritayin issue of it doesn't look right when you're self-dealing in properties that other people have entrusted you with to sell and to monetize. And so for that reason, we would prefer that you don't get involved with it. V'hilchata, the loch is, tzricha shvua. She does require a shvua, this almana who's dealing with the properties without the auspices of Beit Din. She is mocheret v'olechet. She does require a shvua, according to Rashi, shelo gabta yoter, that she didn't take more than she was supposed to, despite the fact that there's a Beit Din shel hedyotot over here, that there is a Beit Din of hedyotot who are assessing the value of the property. Nevertheless, in the end, they just assess the value. They don't know how much she sold it for. They're not in the process of the sale. They simply assess the value. If she sold it for more, there's a possibility that she withheld funds. So she has to take a shvua. Tosafot, shelo zilzala, that she did not sell it below value. And according to The Tosfot read, and other Rishonim, she's taking a Shvua because she's being Poreya from the Yitomim, and this is your classic case of an Almana that has to take a Shvua when she's collecting out of the Yitomim. So state that Tzarei, she doesn't have any other assets that were given to her by the husband that she should have utilized, and therefore she shouldn't be coming to the estate. Ve'eina tzricha hachraza. And she does not require hachraza. So despite the fact that the Gemara rejected the diuk out of Rav Nachman's statement by Rabbi Derei Derova, nevertheless, that was all it was. It was a rejection, but in the end, the Gemara seems to indicate that it is a good diuk, and the din is that we do not require hachraza. We do not require a public auction. Although, again, when it's brought down the halacha in the Torah, he mentions that you do still need an assessment by an outside party. It's not that when we say no hachraza means that she goes ahead and deals one-on-one with private transactions. She still requires the auspices or the assessment of a Beit Din Shel Shlosha. And that Beit Din Shel Shlosha will give you a least semblance of fair value here, but she still cannot self-deal. She's not allowed to sell it to herself. In these instances, despite the fact that she has an outside assessment, either because she was never empowered to sell it to herself because there's nobody selling it to her, or because we're afraid that the assessments will not be done correctly because people know that she's going to be the buyer anyway. All right, next Mishnah. Almana shaitak tubata mataim, umachra shave mane b'mataim. So the tuba of the almana is worth 200, and then she sells shave mane b'mataim. Property worth 100 zuz, she's so good, she sells it at 200. Oh, shave mataim b'maneh, or she's so bad that she sold property worth 200 at 100. Nitkablat tubata. In either instance, she is now paid out on her tuba. Either because she received 200 zuz, and that's all she's entitled to, even though she made it out of 100 zuz of the property, she got 200 zuz, that's fine. And the other way around, true. Shave mataim b'maneh. If she took property valued at 200 and undersold it for 100, she's got her ktubah. Too bad that she caused the losses. She caused the losses for herself. She's got to accept it. In either of these cases, deal's done, and she's been paid out on her ktubah. Now, there are questions about the issues of ona'ah over here. Isn't there a problem of overcharging or undercharging? We know that ona'ah from the Gemara above Metziah equals up to 1/6 of the value. So if you exceed 1/6 of the value in either direction, overpriced or underpriced, then the mekach is batel. Then the mekach is automatically annulled. So over here, we're dealing with the 100% or 50% excess or underage. So why isn't this automatically a mekach batel? So that has to do with the nature of karka. The Rishonim discussed it in Bava Metzia. Over here, Tosafot brings from the Yushalmi. And it happens to be a machoket Rashi and Tosafot. When the Gemara says that there's ein ona'ah the karkaot, ona'ah does not apply to land, because land has a huge amount of subjective value to it. Land is not worth the same thing to everybody, partly to do with proximity, partly to do with location, partly to do with the nature of the produce that the person wants to grow. So therefore, different people over the same parcel of land would be willing to pay very different prices for that land. So because of that, the Gemara says ein ona'ah the karkaot. When we say ain ona la karkot, Rashi says, literally, ain ona la karkot, there is no ona at all. That means, no matter what the level of the pricing is, there is no ona karkot. On the other hand, Tosafot says that it's up to 50%. There are many Rishonim that declare that ona applies to karkot, but that starts only at the 50% threshold. Up until that point, we consider it to be fluctuations in the price or different subjective differences in the price. Once you hit a level of 50% depreciated underpricing, or we'll call it 100% overpricing, then there is ona'ah for karkaot, according to Tosafot. Turns out it's actually a machloket Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in the Yerushalmi, where Rabbi Yochanan says that 50% is the threshold. Reish Lakish says literally, ain ona'ah the karkaot. So Rashi seemingly is taking up the position of Reish Lakish and Tosafot, that of Rabbi Yochanan. Over here, Rashi doesn't discuss it at all. But in Bava Metzia, we have that difference in their opinion. And here, Tosafot quotes the Yushalmi that discusses exactly this. Why in our Mishnah, there is no problem of ona'ah. Haita ktubata maneh. Her ktubah was 100 zuz. Umachra shaveh maneh bidinar bimaneh. She takes a piece of property that's worth 101 and sells it for 100. Mechra batel. then her sale is annulled. Afilu hi omeret. Even if she says, Akzir dinar li yorshim, I'll pay back the extra dinar that was lost here to the yorshim, Mikhrab batel. Still the sale is annulled. So over here, she's owed 100. She's now selling property worth 101, which is an excess of her ketubah. So in a sense, she's not entitled to sell this property. She's not authorized to sell above the value of her ketubah, number one. Number two is, she also sold it for less than the value. It was 101 and she sold it for 100. So she comes in and says, I'll plug the hole. I'll pay the dinar that we missed here. I'll give you the dinar that was missing, number one, because I oversold, and number two is because I underpriced. And I'll make you whole on it. Nevertheless, we say Mikhrab Batel, that the Yitomim can back out and say we want the property back and pay the money for it. B'Shimon Gamliel Omer, Lolam Mikhrab Kayam, Ad Shetei Sham Kedei Shetishayer B'Tzadeh. Then the transaction goes through until there is a large enough plot of land that it would have value as standalone property. The dinar is worth the land, getting that back is not going to do anything for the Yitomim. Because a dinar is worth the land, you can't do anything with it. So he says, therefore the sale stands, and she will have to pay up the dinar over here. When does the sale break? It breaks when the amount of overage that she sold was a large enough plot of land where it's significant standalone. Now, there are three different ways to look at the significance of the standalone, which is that the property itself that she oversold was significant in itself. The money she has to return to the Yitomim is big enough, meaning that whether she underpriced it by that value, whether she took property in excess of her ketubah of that value, or number three is that the Yitomim have adjacent to this property that is significant as a sadeh. Because if they already have property there, to append a dinar worth of property has value. Even though standalone itself, it doesn't have value. So any one of those three items, in that case, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that it would be batel, because in each of those instances, there's a value that's significant enough that we won't say, just keep it up and pay money. We'll say, get the land back and annul the transaction. So then, what are those values? Bisadeh, in a field, it is bat tisha kabin. It's a sadeh, the field where the size is that of 9 kav. Ubigina, and we learn about a garden, then it's bat chatzi kav, and it's a half a kav. These are values that are in the Gemara and Baba Batra as to plots of land that have significance in these contexts. So for sadeh, which we're talking about fields, when you're talking about grains and larger crops, there it's tisha kabin, whereas by a gina, which are smaller vegetable patches, over there it's chatzi kav, ukadivri Rabbi Akiva, beit rova. And if it's Rabbi Akiva, then it's rova kav, beit rova kav. But Rabbi Akiva has a differentiated opinion about how big the plot has to be in order to be significant. So the same would be true over here. Haitah ketubata arba me'od zuz. If her ketubah is worth 400 zuz. Umachra leze b'maneh, uleze b'maneh, uleze b'maneh. She sold off slivers of land, 100 at a time. And then the acharon, for the final one, she did this, 100, 200, 300. Then in the 400, the last 100 that she was entitled to, she sold yafe maneh v'dinar b'maneh. She sold 101 at 100. Shalacharon batel v'sukulan michran kayam. For the final sale is annulled. The earlier sales are not annulled. So for the first 300, each strip of 100 that she sold off, that's fine because she was entitled to that money. It's only that final strip where she oversold. She sold 101 when she was only deserving of 100. Plus, she sold 101 for 100. And there, we will say that the mikra is batel, that her sale is annulled. And the Gemara asks, what was the significance of this? We already saw before that if she oversells or underprices, that the transaction is annulled. Why do you need this again? Maishna shave matayim bimaneh, damri la. We say to Ramala atafsat, you lost, you caused yourself the loss, and therefore you got to eat the loss. It was worth 200, you sold it for 100, you got your ketubah paid out, you eat the loss. Shave maneh b'matayim. If she sells something worth 100 for 200, nami teima anar varchna. Then it's a two-way street. Let her say then that I profited, and it's to my benefit. Why does she lose out in both instances? Why in the case where she undersells the property, she's got to swallow losses? But in the case where she profits, oversells the property, and is able to gain a profit in the property, then why isn't she entitled to keep the profits? So if you're going to blame her for the losses, you should also let her garner the gains. Why in both cases are the Yitomim the beneficiaries of the gain? So I'm Rav Nachman, I'm Rav Ravua, Kan Shana Rabbi, Hakol the Balamot. Rabbi over here taught us that everything goes to the money man. Kedetanya, what is the case here? Hosifulo Achat Yitera. They added him one extra. Hakol the Shaliach. Everything goes to the agent. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Chokim. Rabbi Yossi says that they split it between them. So now, what is the case here? Cases where a balabait empowered an agent, a proxy, a shaliach, to go to the marketplace and purchase items on his behalf. So he goes into the store and he buys items for the balabait. The mocher, the seller, gives him an excess of what he bought. The balabait gave him a certain amount of money, which should have bought him a certain amount of produce at that price. But when he went in there, the seller was generous and gave him more than he was supposed to give him. That excess that he gave him, who does that belong to? So that's the machloket here. Rabbi Yehuda says, "Akol l'shliach." Everything goes to the agent. The agent is the beneficiary of the excess that was given, because he's the one acting. The Baal Bayit gave him money to buy a certain value. He brings that value back. The excess belongs to the agent. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi Omer Chukim, we split it. Rashi says we split it over here because safek. We don't know why the mocher gave it. Did he give it because he likes the shliach? He gave it because he likes the Baal Bayit. And since it's a safek, we're going to give it to both parties. That's the way that Rashi learns it. On the other hand, other Rishonim and the Gonim disagree with Rashi and say that the reason that we're chokim over here is not because it's a fake, but actually because they are both parties to the benefit over here. The idea being that without the monies of the balabayit, the shliach would never be the beneficiary over here. So in a sense, they are partners. The shliach got it because he's the one who actually showed up in front of the seller. On the other hand, the shliach is nothing without the backing of the monies of the balabayit. So the reason they're cholek is because they're actually partners in this transaction. And that's why they're cholek. Not because of the safek, like Rashi says, but rather because they are partners in this transaction. V'atanyo, don't we have a bright Rabbi Yossi Omer, hakol the balamot, that everything goes back to the original party over here. So Amar Rami Barchama lokasho, that's not a problem. Kan bedvar sheish lo kitzva, Kan bidavar, shein lo kitzva. That depends on the nature of the item. If it's an item that is sold in fixed amounts and fixed prices, whether it's an item that is sold without any fixed price to it, it is an object that has, we call it an amorphous value to it. And because of that, the nature of the item can't always be assessed by the amount of money that it is paid. So for instance, if you go into the store, something is sold by weight or sold by numbers, over there, it's clear that when you pay the money, that you would get a certain number of those items. If you get an excess of those items, then it's clear that the mocher gave extra or he gave something more because of the transaction. Now, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that means that it all goes back to the shliach. The buyer is the one who's the beneficiary of that. On the other hand, according to Rabbi Yossi, in that case, you would split it. You'd be chokim. According to Rashi, because it's a fake, when he threw in a baker's dozen, he was supposed to get 12, and instead he got 13. So when he threw in the extra item, the question is, why did he throw in the extra item? Rashi says it's a fake. Maybe it was for the shliach, because he liked the shliach, he gave him an extra one. Or maybe because he was the Baal HaMa'ot, and therefore we split it. According to the others that say that the reason we're cholek is because they were partners here, is because the one who gave the money, he's the one who facilitated the transaction. The shliach is the one who actually made it effective. So we split it between them because they're both beneficiaries of the transaction. Here, Tosafot asks a question, which actually will turn out to be a nafkamina, as he notes, between the two reasons that we brought over here, as to why we're chokim in this case. Shal Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael et Rabbeinu Tam. What happens in a case where the seller made a mistake in giving the change back or in the number? It was not intentional by the mocher, but he made a mistake. And in an instance where it's an amount that would not require you to return it to the seller. So here the seller either made a mistake in the number that he gave or he made a mistake in the change that he returned. In that case, who does it belong to? Does it belong to the Baal HaMa'ot or to the shaliach. So that will really depend on why you think they are chokim. According to the Gaonim that say that they are both parties to the transaction, because the person who gave the money is the one who allowed or facilitated the transaction, and the shliach is the one who carried it out. In this instance, it's no different. Only because there was a transaction, was there a mistake made, and therefore, both of them should share it. In that case, there should be chokim. Whereas according to Rashi, who says that the reason that we are chokim over here is it's a fake, whether the mocher gave it for the benefit of the bala ma'ot, or for the benefit of the shliach, and therefore chokim, over here, that's not relevant. Because mocher did not give it with intent. He did it by accident. It was a mistake. And since it was a mistake, over there, everyone would agree, I call the shliach. That all belongs to the shliach, because it has nothing to do with the bala ma'ot. And therefore here is one of the nafkaminot that you'll actually have between the reasoning of the gonim and the reasoning of Rashi as to why we are chokim over here. In addition to that, Tosva brings two other nafkaminot that would also have this similar outcome, which is where the shliach is hita, the shliach himself misled the seller, and the excess that is garnered here is because of the misleading of the shliach. Again, according to Rashi, that would all go to the shliach. Because according to the Gonim, the only reason the shliach had this ability to do such a thing is because he was funded by the Bala Ma'ot, and they would still be chokim, as well as a case where the mocher specifically states that he's giving the item because of the shliach, because he likes the shliach. In the case for Rashi, that means that the shliach would garner the whole thing. Whereas for the gonim, despite the fact that the individual is saying that he likes the shliach, and that's why he's giving him the item, still, the only reason the shliach is there is because the bala ma'ot funded him to go in for this transaction. And so, and again, he's still a partner to the transaction, even though the mocher is specifically giving it to the shliach. And in all of those instances, according to the reasoning of the gonim, we would still split that profit or that benefit between the bala ma'ot and the shaliach. Even though Tosfot over here says that the Rabbeinu Tam seemingly reversed his opinion over here of chokim and said that it's a call to bala ma'ot, nevertheless he brings from the read that it's a call to shaliach, which would then line up according to the way that we suggested, which is that according to Rashi, where it's a din and safek, and the read seemingly has the same opinion, then in all these cases that we brought, it would go to the shaliach. Whereas the Rabbeinu Tam thought that they'd be chokim, which follows along the way of the Geonim, which he quotes the reasoning here, because all the value was generated by the fact that this transaction existed through the monies of the provider, that's why all these taliyot, or all these cases, they would divide it between the shliach and the ma'ot, would line up according to the positions that we stated in the name of the gonim and Rashi. Whereas the Rabbeinu Tam in the end comes to this conclusion as a call to bala ma'ot, because we would deem it to be a davar she'en lo kitzva in that instance, and therefore it would all go to the bala ma'ot who provided the transaction over here. On the other hand, davar she'en lo kitzva, Rashi gives an example like talit, v'chaluk, v'yerek. These are items that are sold be'omed. They're sold by estimation. You don't sell them at exact prices. You don't weigh the baget. You don't weigh the vegetables, you bundle them and you sell them. So over there, when the person sells them, sometimes they are selling them with a generous eye, sometimes they are selling them with a more miserly eye. So over there, you can't claim that any of it belongs to the shliach in that case, because when the owner sells it, it has nothing to do with the shliach, how much he puts in or doesn't put in over there. It has to do with the way the nature of the sale. The nature of the sale is that in the same transaction, the guy could give more here and less here. It's simply how he's feeling or how he bundles it, because it's not sold at a fixed amount. So therefore, the beneficiary or the party that should benefit over here is the bala ma'ot, is the person who provided the money. Because in the end, the item was given for the monies that were exchanged. It had nothing to do with, okay, the shliach came and I want to be generous, I want to give him extra. It has nothing to do with the extra, because extra can't be determined over here. It's not clear. If he sold him this bundle or that bundle, both of them would have said that that was a fair transaction. So the fact that he got a bigger bundle or a smaller bundle has nothing to do with the shliach, that's simply to do with the nature of this type of transaction, that it's an estimate in the beginning. And so because of that, the party that should be the beneficiary is the bal ha-ma'ot. And that's the answer here. In our instance, by the almanah, that's what Rav Nachman said in the name of Rabbi Baravua, Rabbi here says that everything goes to the Bala Ma'ot. Everything goes to the person who provides the cash. Who's providing the cash or the assets over here? That's the Yitomim. So when she goes and sells, or undersells or oversells, then the party that will be protected here is the Bala Ma'ot. So when she causes losses, she's got to swallow the losses. If she creates gains, the beneficiaries are going to be the Yitomim, not the Shliach. She's the agent. The agent is entitled to that profit. The people that are entitled to the profit are the Yitomim. So now, the Davar She'en Lo Kitzva over here is the land. Land is something that does not have a fixed assessed value, and people could sell that at different prices. So the fact that she garnered a higher price for this land that was worth 100 is no proof that she is such a whiz at selling property. It's just the fact that someone was willing to pay more for that property, and the beneficiary should be the Bala Ma'ot, the one who owns the asset, and that's the Yitomim. And that's why she doesn't get the benefit or the profits when she sells it in excess of its, quote-unquote, assumed or assessed value in the marketplace. There are Rishonim who wanted to divide up here between Kitzva and Inlo Kitzva, between Metaltalim and Karka, that Metaltalim would be things that are considered to be Kitzva, and Karka would be things that are Inlo Kitzva, but many of them reject it because it doesn't seem to divide exactly that way, and they follow more along the lines of what Rashi says over here. It has to do with the nature of how it's sold, not to do with what the object is, but rather the methodology of sale, whether it's sold in exact numbers or weights, where there it's clear that the excess was added because of the transaction, versus a case where it's sold by umad, where it's sold by assessment or general assessment or estimation, where there it's never clear that the person added something or didn't add something because you never know what the real amount is that should be sold in those cases. Although the Rabbeinu Tam here claims that even Rabbi Yehuda would agree in this case to Rabbi Yossi, but davar she'en lo kitzva nami lo ifligu, that in a case where there is no kitzva to the item, even Rabbi Yehuda would agree that a kol the bala ma'ot and not a kol the shliach. So therefore, aval machar lo bezol machmat ma'ot kein mishnatenu, in a case where he sold it cheap, like in the case of our Mishnah, shaveh manebe matayim, he got 200 instead of 100 for a property that was worth 100, they were able to garner 200. Even Rabbi Yehuda would agree in that case that everything belongs to the Bal HaMa'ot. So therefore, Rabbeinu Tam claims that when Rabbi said, Kan Shana Rabbi, they called the Bal HaMa'ot, that's not only according to Rabbi Yossi, but even according to the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda. All right, Amar HaPapa Hilchata, the halacha is, Davar She'esh Lo Kitzva Chokim, something that the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi, and therefore something that has or is sold by a fixed methodology. There they would split it between the shliach, the agent, and the party who is giving the assets or the money here. The davar she'en lo kitzva, something that has no exact methodology of sale, where it's done by estimation, are called the bala ma'ot. And it all goes to the party who is the providing the assets or the monies over here, because that's the nature of this type of sale. Where it says, Maikamashulan, what did Rav Papa just add for us? Basically, we just saw that. We know the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi versus Rabbi Yehuda, and we just saw this distinction in Rabbi Yossi's position. So then, what is Rav Papa adding by telling us the halacha is this way? Seemingly, that would have been your conclusion anyway. So, shinuya, dishanina, and shinuyahu. That's what he's coming to tell us, that the distinction that you drew was a good distinction. Meaning that the idea before that we split, or we divided up Rabbi Yossi's opinions in this manner, that was a good distinction that was drawn, and that's what Rav Papa says. That the halacha is this way because that distinction that you drew was a proper chiluk within the position of Rabbi Yossi, and therefore the halacha is going to be this way. Ibailu, amar le zaven le litcha, v'azal v'zaven le kura. So a person says to his agent, go ahead and buy me a letech. Letech worth of land. Letech is half a kur. So he empowers the agent to go buy a letech. Instead, the agent goes ahead and buys a kur, which is double the amount that the balabait sent him to buy. Right. My. So how do we look at this? Mosif al devarav hu, he was carrying out the agency, but then he just did a little more than he was empowered to do. V'litcha mi'akoni. But then, in that sense, one of the transactions will stand. He bought a kur, which is made up of two letechs. So in that case, is he still an agent for the first letech? And then the excess will be unwound because he wasn't empowered to do the second half. But at least for the first half of the transaction, he was empowered, and therefore that transaction would stand. Odilma mavir al dvaravu v'litcha nami lokani. Or do we say that there was a breach in his agency, and therefore he lost his power as an agent because he didn't listen to the Bala Bayit? And therefore, the entire transaction will be annulled because he's no longer the agent of the Baal HaBayit. So the question in general, where an agent, by shlichut, if a shliach does not carry out the agency that he was empowered to do, what happens at that point? Now clearly, if he does the wrong thing entirely, then he's not an agent for that, because the Baal HaBayit will say, L'tikunei sher dartich, I sent you to do good for me, not to do something wrong. So in that instance, it's clear that he's no longer an agent, and there's been a breach in his agency, and he's acting on his own, and he's not acting on behalf of the Baal HaBayit. Over here, the problem is that the agency is subsumed in what he did, in the totality of what he did. So in that case, how do we view it? Do we view it as being two discrete transactions, which is, he carried out his agency, plus he did this? Or do we look at it as one big package, and there was a breach in his agency, he misled the buyer, or he did something wrong, because the Baal HaBayit asked him for X, and he did 2X. So therefore, he didn't carry out his agency, he's no longer an agent. So that's the question. When you're Mosif, are you now an agent plus, or are you abrogated the agency completely? So now the Gemara says, let us look. Amar Rav Yaakov min Har Poglin, Mishmei de Ravina, Tashma. Let us look at this from a case in Me'ila. Amar Baal HaBayit l'shlucho, ten lehem chaticha l'orchim. So the Baal HaBayit says to his agent, to his steward, go ahead and serve the guests one piece of meat each. Now, Me'ila is an unusual circumstance because Me'ila, number one, you're only chayav if it's b'shogeg. Me'ila is misappropriation of hekdesh. Misappropriation of hekdesh requires you to replace it, the keren, pay an extra chomesh, and bring a korban me'ila. So that's what happens if someone is mo'el. That's only true when you are mo'el b'shogeg. If it's unintentional that you did the me'ila, this misappropriation of hekdesh. That's number one. The number two chiddush in me'ila is there is shliach l'dvar aveira. In general, we have a principle that you cannot be a shliach l'dvar aveira. Over here, me'ila has agency, even in the case where it's going to obligate the Baal HaBayit. So over here, the Baal HaBayit sent in a shliach, and he tells him, give the orchim one piece of meat each. V'omer tlu shtayim. And he says to the guests, each of you, go ahead, take two. V'ein natlu shalosh. Then they took three. Kulan malu. Every one of these parties has a problem of me'ila on their hands. If they afterwards find out that the meat was hektesh, each one of these parties is now obligated in me'ila for their one piece of meat. If you say over here that the agent was agent plus, then mishumachi Baal HaBayit mal. That's why the Baal HaBayit here is mo'el. Because the agent went ahead and said, take two pieces of meat. One is for the Baal HaBayit. That's why the Baal HaBayit now is chayev in me'ila. One was of his own volition, where he offered them an extra piece of meat. That's why he's mo'el. And then the guests are mo'el, because they took a third piece without the permission of either of the two parties. So that's why everybody has me'ila, because the agency is still intact. If you say that when he offered them two instead of one, that he abrogated the agency, Baal HaBayit on my mouth. Why is then the Baal HaBayit have any me'ila over here? The agent lost his right as an agent. He's no longer the proxy of the Baal HaBayit. That means that it's his problem for both of them, both pieces of meat, and the Baal HaBayit is not on the hook for any of this. Vatznan. Don't we have a Mishnah of a shliach she'asa shlichuto, Baal HaBayit ma'al? That if the shliach acted on behalf of the Baal HaBayit, meaning he carried out his agency properly, then the Baal HaBayit is ma'al. This is again this idea of shliach l'dvar aveira by me'ila. Lo asa shlichuto, shliach ma'al. On the other hand, if he did not carry out his agency properly, then it's the shliach's problem because he abrogated the agency. The Baal HaBayit is no longer on the hook. He acted on his own volition. Now he's on the hook for the me'ila. So if that's the case, here's a good proof to the fact that he's viewed as an agency plus and not as an abrogation of the entire agency. Gemara says, no, achu ma'iskinan. The case here is the damerlu that he said to the guests, so he says, listen, one's on the house, one's on me, and then shaklu inu tlat, and then they took one on their own. So that's why over there, despite the fact that he abrogated the agency, because of the way that he phrased it, that kept the Baal HaBayit in the picture. Because he said, take one for the Baal HaBayit and one from me. So he made it clear that his agency was only for that one, and then the additional one was of his own volition. And that's why he didn't abrogate the agency in that case. So maybe we would argue that you have no proof from here. The reason that it works over here has nothing to do with the fact that agency plus is still deemed to be agency, but rather it's because of the way that he phrased it in this issue that he maintained his agency by telling them that it came from the Baal HaBayit and separating out his contribution. So Tashma. So let's say from our Mishnah. Her ktuba was only worth 100. There was 100 left in it, or was worth 100. And she sells 101 of property for 100. Michra batel. Over there, her sale is batel. My love, what is the scenario here? The zavin shave maneh v'dinar b'maneh v'dinar. Enoch nami. She sold property worth 101 for 101. It's not like we read it in the Mishnah that she undersold it for 100, but rather, she sold it for 101. Umay b'maneh. So then what does the maneh mean? B'maneh shala. Because she needed 100. That's what it means. Not that she sold 101 for 100. She sold 101 for 101, but to garner her 100 out of that 101. Umay afilo. What is the afilo in the Mishnah that even if she offers the Yitomim to give them back the dinar, afilo yomeret, akzir the dinar liyorshim, b'dinar mikarkei, even if she offers to give back the dinar to the Yitomim, not in money, but in land, she's willing to give the dinar worth of land back to them, viktani, and it says, michra batel, that her sale is batel. Why is her sale over there batel? She was an agent, she was empowered to sell for 100, because her ktubah was worth 100, she's mocheret v'olechet. Oh, what did she do in the end? She sold 101. She went in excess of agency. What does our Mishnah say? Michra batel. She loses all rights to agency over there. So here's a proof to the fact that when the agent adds on, he's not considered to be agency plus, but rather an abrogation of the agency, and it doesn't work at all. I'm Ravuna Breda Rav Natan. Lo, lo, lo. Don't read it that way. Bidolzil, the way that we read it in the Mishnah. What was the problem here? She sold 101 of property for 100. She undersold the value of the property. And that's why the transaction is being unwound here. Gemara says, "Bahamid the Sefer ba'ozil, havereisha b'dilo ozil." Wait a minute. If the Sefer already is talking about a case of where she undervalued it, then the Reisha should be a case where she did not undervalue it. So that's the case, the final case in the Mishnah, where she had 400 worth of ktubah, and she sold it off in slices of 100, 100, 100, and the last one, she sold 101 for 100. There, it's a case where she clearly was mozil. Toso, it says, lo'efsha l'faresh l'achron yafem maneh v'dinar, b'maneh v'dinar, that you can't explain that last case as being a case where she sold 101 for 101. U'bamay maneh maneh shala, dak tubata dalet me'od zuze. Because her tuba was worth 400 zuz. So that can't be what the meaning of that last statement is over there. So therefore, the last case is clearly a case where she was ozil, she undersold it. So you already have that in the Mishnah. So our case over here probably is not talking about a case where she undersold it, which is where she sold it at fair value. The ozil, the tani seifa, the seifa says, I talk to atar ba meod zuz. If her ktuba is worth 400, machra le zeb maneh, acharon yafem maneh v'dinar b'maneh, and she sold the last party, 101 for 100, shel acharon michra batel. V'shokulan michra nekayam. The final sale is annulled, but everybody else's pieces beforehand where she was empowered, those are all intact because in that case, she sold what she was entitled to sell, and she sold it at fair value. So Gemara says, "Lo, reisha b'seifa b'dozil." Both cases are a case where she undervalued it. B'seifa hakamash malan. Then why do I need you to tell me two cases in the Mishnah, which was what I mentioned when we read the Mishnah? Why do I need you to tell me twice that she sells 101 worth of property in excess of what she's allowed to sell, and she undersells it, that the transaction's annulled? In the case where a ketubah is worth 100, and she sells 101 of property for 100, we say annulled. And a case where ktubah is worth 400, and she sells 100, 100, 100, and the last 100, if she sells a property worth 101 for 100, then it's annulled as well. Those are exactly the same case. So why do I need both of them? Kmashlan, taima de ozil b'diyatme, aval b'dido michra kayam. Number one is to teach you that when she depreciates the value of the Yitomim's property, that's when we say that it is annulled. But if she undervalues her own property, we say the sale goes through and she swallows the losses. So if she uses 101 worth of property and sells it for 100, then we say to her, you got 101 worth of value. That's the amount of your ktubah that was paid out. That we're okay with. But if you did it on the dime of the Yitomim, then we're going to reverse the transaction. Gemara says, Hamidureisha shamat mina. We already know that from the first case in the Mishnah. The first case in the Mishnah was we sold property worth 200 for 100. And we say that the transaction goes through. There she takes the loss. She swallows the loss. We know that already from the first case in the Mishnah. She got her ktubah. So we know that when the losses come, the losses accrue to her. And she has to swallow the losses. So we already know that from the first case. I would have thought the reason that that works over there is because we threw her out of, she's gone. She took care of her entire ketubah in this transaction, and that's why we have her swallow all the losses. Avahocha nigzor mane rishon ata mane acharon. Over here, our fear is that if she misvalued the first one, she's also going to misvalue the last one. Kamash malon, that we don't say that. So over here, our fear is, and again, in the first two cases of the Mishnah, a case where she sells 200 for 100, or in the case where she sells 101 for 100, where that's the entire value of her ketubah, over there, she's gone. She misvalued the property. But she's out. She's out of the picture at this point. So in the case where she's out of the picture, we say, let her swallow the losses, and she's gone. Now, the case where it was 100 for 100, she ate into the Yatomim's property, then we say, you got to back out of the transaction. So in the final case, why over there do we say that there's value in telling us that story? The value of that story is two parts to it. One is that when it's the final leg, we reverse it, because then she's eating into the Yatomim's property. Oh, you told me that already in the middle case in the Mishnah. That's to come to teach us. The first 300 she sold are good, even if she undervalued it. Okay, but you told me that in the ratio. No, in the ratio where she undervalued it, she's gone. She did one bad transaction, and she swallows what, but she's out. The problem here is, if she did the first transaction badly, we can assume that she's going to do three more bad transactions over here, and then eventually that's going to eat into the Yatomim's losses. But the Mishnah comes to tell us it doesn't matter. She'll swallow the losses up to the level of Ketubah, and all of those sales will be fine. The final sale where she does it will reverse the transaction, because that's losses that will be assigned to the Yatomim. So what's telling us is, even if we have evidence of the fact that she's misvaluing the properties here, nevertheless, we will allow her to continue to lose for herself, as long as she's losing for herself. And those transactions will all stand. As soon as she hits a transaction that causes losses to the Yatomim, then we will force it to be unwound. But we let her, even though she's given us reason to believe that she's not good at this, nevertheless, we will still let her do it because she's causing herself the losses and not other parties the losses. Okay, we'll stop over here, 13 lines down on the top of Tzadi Ted Amud Aleph.